Today we continue our discussion on the northern invasion of Ezekiel 38 and 39. I'm Dr. Fred. Join me for another episode of Study, Grow, Know.
Welcome to Study, Grow, Know, where we discuss theology, prophecy, and current political issues from a conservative biblical perspective. Here's your host, Dr. Fred DeRubo.
Thank you for joining me. Last time we were talking about the northern invasion of Ezekiel 38 and 39, and we're going to continue that discussion today. We talked about the fact that Israel is living securely today, and because of that, even though many of us would look at that and say, wow, how can that be secure? That seems to be a very insecure situation. But as far as Israel's concerned, they believe that right is on their side. They believe that God of the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible, is on their side. Therefore, there's nothing that they can't do. Unfortunately, as we know, they have rejected the Messiah, Jesus Christ. Therefore, God is not on their side per se. God is on his side. And the reason he is going to defend Israel, the reason he is going to keep them safe, so to speak, has nothing to do with them, because they defile his name. And they're continuing to defile his name. The reason he is going to save Israel and stand in for Israel and protect them and keep them from being obliterated by countries like Iran is solely because of the fact that he wants to bring glory and honor to his name. It has nothing to do with Israel. It has everything to do with God and his promises that he made. You know, I live securely with my family in our home. And by that, I do not believe that no one would ever try to break into my house or try to steal things from me. I mean, I'm not naive. It is for that reason that I have locks on the windows and doors. When we leave for the day, all of those individual locks are used to make our home as secure as possible. Now, if I really believe that no one would ever try to steal from me, I'd never worry about closing the garage door. I would keep the windows and doors unlocked, whether I was home or not. Living securely means that a person believes that they are protected from outside forces who might wish to do them harm, whether it's a burglar or something else. We have made our home as burglar-proof as possible so that when we go to sleep at night or are away during the day, we consider the chance of someone breaking in successfully to be rather remote. Now, at the same time, we know that all of our actions have not guaranteed that we'll never experience the unpleasantness from a break-in. A good many people go through their days thinking that evil will not touch them. It will always happen to someone else, not to them. They'll not be hurt in a car accident or killed. They won't be mugged, beaten, raped, or murdered. That happens to other people. Okay, that's not living securely. That is living in a fantasy. They've made no preparations for the potential possibilities of something bad happening. Now, when I get into my car, the first thing that I do is lock my doors. It is amazing to me how many people do not do this simple thing that really creates the first deterrent. When I'm walking someplace, I'm constantly aware of my surroundings. When I'm at home, I may leave the front door open, but the security screen is closed and locked. This causes me to feel a bit more secure about my environment, and it is because I know that things can happen that I take precautions. Obviously, a security screen door isn't going to stop someone who really wants to get into the house. A window closed and locked is not going to really stop someone from getting into my home. However, it gives me the upper hand because it's going to take a few seconds for them to get in, and hopefully I will have been alerted and can take secondary precautions. This is Israel today. She's surrounded by Arab nations who hate her and want her gone. As a matter of fact, most of the world believes that Israel has no right to be where they are. These nations don't believe there's room for the state of Israel in, quote-unquote, their area of the world. They hate Israel. And Islam itself teaches that Jews should be killed. That's considered an honorable thing as far as Allah is concerned. The truth of the matter is that in spite of these constant threats, Israel is fairly secure because of her armies, her navies, and her technology through which Israel is protected. That is what allows them to live securely. It is this type of situation in which Israel currently exists that Gog, G-O-G, will consider attacking Israel. And we mentioned him last time. After all, this is what happened to start the Six-Day War in 1967. The nations that came against Israel did so on the Sabbath. Those nations were actually overconfident. They believed that if they attacked Israel on the Sabbath, she would have no chance to defend herself. They would have the upper hand, and ultimately, they would overtake Israel. This was the case early on, initially, but over time, within a few weeks, the tables were turned during that 1967 Six-Day War, and it allowed Israel to not only gain the upper hand, but they gained more land. That land, for the most part, is still part of Israel today. And the Arab nations surrounding Israel don't like it. Yet they're the ones who attacked Israel in the first place. It would be like if someone broke into your home, they tried to overcome you and overpower you. In effect, you overpowered them and took the weapons that they were trying to use against you. Then later on, they came back and tried to force you to give them their weapons back. It's stupid. It's ludicrous. But this is what's happening. And most of the world goes, yep, that's right. The Palestinians deserve their own state. The Arab nations deserve to have their land back. No, they don't. And as far as the Palestinians are concerned, the Palestinians is a group that was created literally by Yasser Arafat. Years ago, decades ago, anyone living in Palestine was called a Palestinian. Didn't matter if you were Jew or Gentile. Yasser Arafat came along and decided, I know, I'm going to create a special culture, a special ethnicity, a special group of people. We're going to call them Palestinians, and we're going to fight for their right to have their own state within Israel. Now, the problem with that is that these Palestinians of today are nothing more than Arabs. There's no special language, no special culture group, no special ethnicity, but they're treated as if they are. Now, getting back to Gog, when Gog decides to turn against Israel, his armies will be so large that the dirt cloud from this oncoming invasion will cover the land, quite possibly darkening the entire visible sky. This is a large army, folks. We're not talking about, you know, small potatoes here. There is some argument about whether or not Gog will lead his troops on actual horses. I've talked to people who are preterists and covenant theologians and reformed theologians, and they basically make the argument that if you're going to take the Bible literally, then you have to believe that Gog is going to use horses and literally shields and swords, because that's what it states in verse 15. Do we have to literally understand these to be actual horses, or is this a general term that is used throughout Scripture, like swords, for instance, to imply war? Though I believe God meant this part of Ezekiel to refer to these people of latter days, the first people to hear about this were the people of Ezekiel's day, the Israelites. Those people knew of horses, bows, arrows, shields, and bucklers as normal instruments used in warfare. They would not have known about tanks, heat-seeking missiles, helicopters, jets, and other modern-day weaponry, and it would have thoroughly confused them. I think it's safe to say that though God used the term horses in Scripture in describing Gog's army and how they would move against Israel, it is very likely that this is used to literally refer to the general sense of war-related vehicles and armaments. Today, it's highly doubtful that horses would be used in an attack such as the one of this magnitude, unless, of course, that part of the world experienced a massive EMP, electromagnetic pulse, knocking out everything that runs on some type of electricity. If that were the case, then there would be room to use horses in the equation. Horses require food and water. Tanks, jets, and other modern weaponry require some form of fuel, as well as electricity, and the fuel generally uses an engine to generate electricity, which is easy enough to attain in the Middle East. God seems to simply be speaking in general terms here. What we're going for when we speak of understanding Scripture literally is the literal meaning. Terms that Ezekiel and his people would have understood to refer to things used in time of war. The point God is making here is not what type of vehicle Gog and his troops will use in their attempted invasion of Israel. The real point is the size of the total army that's being utilized. This is going to be a huge affair, one that will not be hidden from the world. This army will be so large that the dust trail from the vehicles will darken the sky and will be noticed for miles. Do you think the world's going to see this? You bet the world is going to see this. And that's God's plan. Certainly in today's day and age, lightning-fast technology, the attempt at invasion will be picked up and carried by satellites, which will then transmit their signals, pictures, videos to TVs, phones, and computers. No mention of these things is noted in the text, by the way, but it can be implied that something on such a large scale as this would not go unnoticed by the world. Now, verses 10 through 13 tells us that the reason for this attempted invasion, realizing, of course, that God himself sets things in motion. As far as Gog is concerned, he will not be aware that God has set things in motion. He will think that he came up with the idea and will have specific reasons for doing what he thinks is his idea. Now, here's what God says if we read verses 10 through 13 in the book of Ezekiel chapter 38. Quote, "It will come about on that day that thoughts will come into your mind and you will devise an evil plan and you'll say, I will go up against the land of unwalled villages. I will go against those who are at rest, that live securely, all of them living without walls and having no bars or gates, no cat to capture spoil. And to seize plunder, to turn your hand against the waste places which are now inhabited and against the people who are gathered from the nations, who have acquired cattle and goods, who live at the center of the world. Sheba and Dedan and the merchants of Tarshish with all its villages will say to you, have you come to capture spoil? Have you assembled your company to seize plunder, to carry away silver and gold, to take away cattle and goods, to capture great spoil?" Unquote. This is fascinating to me. God, Jehovah, basically says that on that specific day that Jehovah himself will ordain, God will contemplate the thoughts that come through his mind. These thoughts will cause him to, quote, devise an evil plan. And in so doing, Gog will believe that he has come up with this idea to attack Israel all by himself. Now, in truth, of course, God is the one who brought things together and simply dropped thoughts into God's head. It is also that God uses an evil spirit, literally, to put those thoughts into Gog's head. Now, in either case, Jehovah credits himself with it and blames Gog for following those instincts that these thoughts create. God's plan, Gog, G-O-G, his plan seems reasonable to him. All of a sudden, he thinks about Israel, as he's probably done so many times before, and this time, it's as if he has a breakthrough. This time, he asks himself the question, hey, why can't I simply go up against Israel and overcome them? Take what I want. Who's going to stop me? Well, the answer is that no one, he thinks, is going to stop him. And he certainly does not believe that Israel will be any real match for him and his huge army. So he becomes emboldened because of his plan. He considers the unwalled villages of Israel. More than one commentator has indicated that this description sounds very much like a kibbutz. This is a communal village that normally has no walls around it in Israel. Groups of people live there and share what they grow among themselves. The many unwalled villages, or kibbutzim, provide us another indication that the people of Israel believe they're living securely. If they did not believe they were secure with the ability to overcome every threat, they would certainly not be living in areas with no walls. They don't do this. They have themselves really vulnerable positions. They're invulnerable positions without those walls. Now, I know who people who have wrought iron security bars on their doors and windows of their homes. It's a pain to unlock this door, then that one, then the wrought iron doors. They have special releases on the inside of their windows in case of a house fire that will let them escape the flames. But the problem is, they feel very safe. However, the reality is, it's quite possible they have exaggerated their own threat, and because of the wrought iron bars, they feel as though their home is impenetrable. Maybe it isn't. But in this sense, Israel believes they're safe. Well, we're done for today. Thank you so much. We're going to continue next time. And until then, may God show you how richly blessed you truly are.
You've been listening to Study, Grow, Know with Dr. Fred DeRuvo. please join us each week for new broadcasts that deal with theology, prophecy, and political issues from a biblical, conservative perspective.